The following is for your ears only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Sequester countdown, Obama and the GOP escalate the blame game, gun control at the grassroots, and more governors accept Medicaid expansion.
Behind and beyond the block on Hagel. Past partisan slights aside, a new view on U.S. intervention, past, present, and future.
Cyber war, the China challenge, what the U.S. has learned about cyber assaults and plans to combat it.
Discovering Black America, the author of a new book spotlights some lesser-known pioneers for Black History Month.
Cruise blues, how Carnival handled the Triumph trial at sea and after, and the pros and cons of mass cruising.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of February 24th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
Now, if Congress allows this meat cleaver approach to take place, it will jeopardize our military readiness. It will eviscerate job-creating investments in education and energy and medical research. It won't consider whether we're cutting some bloated program that has outlived its usefulness or a vital service that Americans depend on every single day.
If you want to look at ways to find $1.2 trillion in savings over the next decade, let's look at Obamacare. Let's don't destroy the military and just cut blindly across the board.
If you can't spell sequestration, try C-H-I-C-K-E-N. Playing chicken is pretty much what's going on in Washington over the plan on which both parties agreed for drastic autopilot budget cuts as a threat so dire it would force some budget compromise to reduce the growing deficit. President Obama and his top aides last week detailed the damage that could begin within days if there's no deal on a wiser formula of spending cuts and tax increases, which Republicans continue to reject.
GOP Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina targeted Obama's new Affordable Care Act as a prime pot of cash for cutting. But days later, the president won belated, if begrudging, Republican support for Obamacare when no less a former critic than Florida Governor Rick Scott reversed himself and joined other states taking advantage of its expanded Medicaid option, with Washington paying all the increased cost at first and 90% thereafter. Obama's call for more action against gun violence, meanwhile, began making new progress at the grassroots. To review those political developments and more, for your ears only, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a NewsweekDailyBeast.com contributor. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
For all the threats of service and job losses under sequestration, do you sense a willingness to let it happen, at least briefly, to increase pressure for the compromise Democrats want, or to get the kind of major spending cuts some conservatives have only dreamed about for years?
Well, the sticking point is really the fact that the Republicans don't want to offer anything in the way of new revenue, not necessarily raising taxes, but even closing loopholes, which they had offered in previous bargaining. And the president doesn't want to embark on a plan which is only spending cuts without new revenue. And so I think the left and the right both see some wisdom in letting the sequestration go forward, because liberals get defense cuts that they never would be able to get in any other scenario without being, you know, ridiculed as peacenicks. And the right gets the spending cuts that they get, that they want, and they also don't have to accept any increase in taxes, which is the centerpiece of their party. So each side comes away with something in sequester, and the big question mark is how hurtful will it be to ordinary people, and will it trigger a political backlash?
Well, current polls and the last election show more public support for Obama and his positions than for Republicans and theirs. So how do the GOP leaders see a benefit from sequester beyond the facts that you just stated?
Well, I think Republicans are saying, well, sequester, even though $85 billion sounds like a lot of money, it's a very small percentage of the overall budget, and they don't really think that the public is going to feel the pain. And any pain the public feels, they claim, is manipulated by the president to try to increase his bargaining power. So they're not accepting the polls that, that suggest that they could be the party that takes most of the blame for this sequester if it goes forward.
They have a little problem, as Karl Rove showed on television, of accepting polls that don't agree with their positions. Republican leaders have blamed Obama for not dealing more directly with them on budget issues. But we heard there were White House overtures to some GOP opponents to Obama nominees for Secretary of Defense and CIA Director, offers of information previously kept secret. What can you tell us?
Well, I think the mystery that remains is exactly what did the president do the night of the Benghazi attack, and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, among others, want a detailed report of exactly who the president talked to, you know, the timeline, whether he was pressing for more assistance to the embattled consulate. And so the White House has been reluctant to reveal any of those internal deliberations. And so, maybe they're going to give more. It seems to me that the Republicans are trying to find evidence of some sort of a cover-up because they believe that the talking points that U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice went on the Sunday shows with were somehow doctored along the way. And that may be another possibility where the administration can reveal more of, you know, the original raw talking points and exactly which agency affected them. They started out at the CIA, apparently. But the CIA's involvement in this, which apparently is quite dominant, I think is what has prevented the administration from being more forthcoming. And I think Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham know that, and why they keep pressing for details that really can't be discussed in an open forum seems to me, a little bit they're using this as a political whipping boy.
Well, some reports say that fatal attack on the U.S. diplomatic outpost in Benghazi, about which John McCain has been demanding to know more, was actually prompted by a CIA effort there to monitor and even direct a post-Gaddafi flow of arms to anti-Assad forces in Syria. Ironically, just what McCain himself has been calling for. What's your view on that?
It just seems to me that McCain should understand that some of these efforts, even if he favors them and has been calling for them, are not something that the administration can talk about openly. And maybe they can go into closed session. McCain is a mercurial personality. He's now out there as a front man on immigration reform, and some of his listeners may have caught some of the flack he was taking at a town meeting in Arizona, and he was holding up pretty well. But he's got a tough electorate there in Arizona when it comes to immigration reform, and so he's now kind of out there on the flank, you know, for something that the administration wants. So, you know, with McCain, he may be against you on an issue one day, but just wait a while. He might be a friend the next day. He's a very mercurial personality.
What do you make of the high-priced ground war between pro- and anti-gun forces around the country now, where congressional races could be tipped?
Well, it's been a one-sided war for such a long time, with the NRA pouring in lots of money into races and really, you know, scaring away people who didn't have an A rating from the NRA. And so now you've got several groups, Mayor Bloomberg's group, you've got Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, with their super PAC. So you've got some players on the other side now putting money in. And I guess the seat in northern New York, which was mostly a Republican seat, recently went Democratic, and the Bloomberg group, and also I think Mark Kelly and Gabby Giffords are putting money into that race. It can make a difference in congressional races, because congressional races, often the public isn't paying that close attention, and if you put enough money in there and whip up one side or the other, you can definitely make a difference.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a Newsweek DailyBeast.com contributor.
Quote from the news, "The accused has made a case." That was Pretoria, South Africa magistrate Desmond Nair agreeing on bail for prosthetic-dependent track star Oscar Pistorius, pending trial in the fatal shooting of his blonde model girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. Inconsistencies in defense testimony were matched by problems with the police investigation. Also last week, the U.S. Justice Department decided to join a lawsuit against admitted doping cyclist champion Lance Armstrong.
Next, Behind and Beyond the Hegel Roadblock, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. He was eager to cooperate in whatever way he could. That was a spokesman for the Archdiocese of New York on Cardinal Timothy Dolan being deposed about the sexual abuse of children by priests in Milwaukee while he was archbishop. Similarly deposed before flying to Rome to vote on a new pope, Cardinal Roger Mahoney, forced out as Archbishop of Los Angeles. Meanwhile, a papal spokesman denied the Italian newspaper report that Benedict XVI decided to resign because of a dossier indicating high-level Vatican financial and homosexual improprieties. Now this.
The comment I made about the most dangerous foreign policy decision since Vietnam was about not just the surge, but the overall war of choice going into Iraq.
We will have a vote when we get back, and I'm confident that Senator Hagel will probably have the votes necessary to be confirmed as the Secretary of Defense.
Despite a nasty confirmation confrontation with former Senate Republican colleague and fellow Vietnam vet Chuck Hagel, President Obama's defense secretary-designate, Arizona's John McCain last week predicted the nomination would pass, albeit without his vote.
The unprecedented battle over a nomination for the top Pentagon post had many roots. Some were narrowly partisan, notably Haig's criticism of the last Bush presidency and backing for Obama over McCain 4 years ago. There were also questions about Hagel's support for Israel and rumors about him taking fees from a group called Friends of Hamas, though such a group never existed beyond one reporter's wisecrack to a Republican aide. And some Obama critics were simply holding out for more information about the fatal attack on a U.S. post in Benghazi, Libya.
Far more significant for American foreign policy going forward was the issue over which Hagel and McCain had their sharpest exchanges, the wisdom and effectiveness of U.S. military intervention. That was the topic of an essay last week by Sarwar Kashmiri, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center for Atlantic Security and author of NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete. And for your ears only, Professor Kashmiri joins us again now. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
Remind us of the conservative Republican view of U.S. military intervention as stated during last year's election campaign by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Absolutely. So she summarized it wonderfully by saying that the United States must lead everywhere in the world, because if we don't lead, if the U.S. doesn't lead, then either nobody will lead or the people who will lead will not have the same national interests. And this is, of course, a summary of the classic neocon position that the United States military is the most powerful in the world, and so we ought to be using it to transform countries. And the second part of it is that we ought to start in the forlorn area of the Middle East and use our military to transform those countries into mirror images of the United States.
Well, the Iraq War was a test case for that policy. What are the objective facts about success there?
If you look at Iraq, look at the strategic position of Iraq before the American invasion. You had Sunni Iraq, you have Shia Iran, and both of them together were holding the balance of power and neutral in the Middle East. I'm reminded of the famous Henry Kissinger quote when the Iraq-Iran war was going on and a reporter asked him who he thought should win, and Dr. Kissinger said, "I hope both sides win." So one of the most important negative aspects of the American invasion was that we blew up the state of Iraq, which was a dictatorship but was a functioning nation, and we totally destroyed that equilibrium in the Middle East. Now Iran is gaining more influence. The nation is a failed state. The middle class has left. We are left with bombings in Iraq, and we've achieved really nothing for $1 trillion and 4,500 American dead and close to 1 million Iraqi dead.
We also get divergent reports on Afghanistan. The administration claims progress, but official studies suggest real doubt about the capability of government forces to hold off a Taliban resurgence.
Well, again, that's the used to be a standard equation in geopolitics that if you were a powerful country and you went in and invaded another country, and if you had more power than the other country, then you could put your will on the other country, get them to do what you do. What the last decade has shown is that equation has broken down, so that the United States has gone in, the most powerful country in the world, achieved little or nothing in Iraq, achieved little or nothing in Afghanistan. Now we're about to leave. And the latest reports are that it will take 350,000 people in the Afghani security forces to try and maintain a hold on the Taliban. That will cost about $6.5 billion, of which the United States will have to pay about $5.7 billion. 27 other countries in the NATO alliance will cough up a paltry $300 million, and the Afghans are only able to afford about $500 million. So that's the state of affairs that we're headed into in the last 2 years. We've achieved very little. The Taliban are gaining strength, and I really don't know where this goes.
Now you see new pressure for military solutions to Syria's civil war, Iran's nuclear development, and Islamists in Africa with new drone bases there.
Absolutely, and I think the wise thing to do here would be to stay clear in Mali. The Syrian situation is a good one. There was a report last week from the United Nations that accused both the Sadat regime and the insurgency of human rights violations and suggested both be taken to the court in Hague. So now here you have a situation where I think wisely the president has said, let's not jump in with troops. We don't know which side we are going to be wanting to support. It's a civil war. And I think the administration, in my opinion, has taken a very nice approach as uninvolved as some people think they are. It's better not to get involved than get involved in such a way that doesn't help American national interests.
There were questions about Mali. You wrote that the French had it well in hand, but the late reports are that the French are now worried about becoming bogged down and the drone bases to keep more intelligence coming in is causing controversy. I wonder if you think the U.S. would be more responsive to challenges like Mali if the Pentagon's Africa Command was actually based in Africa, not Stuttgart, Germany, and why isn't it?
There is no African country besides Niger that wants to have an American presence there because most of these countries believe that the United States only wants to be there to counter the Chinese influence on the natural resources of Africa. That's what many of the Africans believe. So they have not wanted Africa Command there. It's not that the U.S. didn't want to be there. It's that most of the African countries where the Africa Command wanted to be based did not want it to be based. And so it was based in Stuttgart, and the latest information is that it might be moved to Florida. So the idea that we need to have these bases in Africa, I think, is very misguided, because Mali is a Muslim country. You know, at this point, we are not in very high regard by just about any Muslim country. The U.S. has invaded a whole number of them, and do we really want to go through all of that in Mali?
Salwar Kashmiri is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center for Atlantic Security and author of NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete.
Quote from the news, showing itself once more as a valuable ally. That was International Crisis Group analyst Yasser El-Shimi after Egypt's new Muslim Brotherhood regime began blocking the stream of contraband munitions and goods to Gaza by flooding the tunnels there from Sinai with sewage.
Next, China's cyber challenge for your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. While the decision seems big, it wasn't difficult. That was Marine General John R. Allen, previous top commander in Afghanistan, on retiring to care for his ailing wife rather than become supreme commander of NATO. Allen also had been caught in the email scandal that led to the resignation of former Afghan commander and CIA director David Petraeus. Now this.
We have repeatedly raised our concerns at the highest levels about cyber theft with senior Chinese officials, including in the military, and we will continue to do so.
For all the headlines about cyber war last week, White House spokesman Jay Carney maintained a professional calm over the new report that an overwhelming percentage of Internet attacks on U.S. organizations, corporations, and government agencies emanated from a nondescript White Office building in Shanghai, home to People's Liberation Army Unit 61398, sometimes called the Comment Crew or the Shanghai Group.
Still, the situation had plenty of Americans concerned in and out of government, not only about the damage being done, but about unintended consequences and controversies from new countermeasures based in law or technology. To consider both cyber raids and responses, for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Tech News World writer Peter Suchu. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
There's talk about terabytes of information stolen, or rather copied, as it mostly remains on targeted computers. What is a terabyte in terms that we can understand?
Well, put simply, terabyte is kind of the next level after gigabyte, whereas gigabyte is 1 million bits of information, terabyte is a trillion. With ever-increasing data, what we're now calling big data, the numbers are simply getting bigger. Next, we'll hear about petabytes, then extrabytes, then zettabytes, and then yottabytes, and after that, something else.
Or as my dentist would say, overbytes. We know in one special case, Chinese hackers went after logins and sources of some news organizations reporting on improper financial activities linked to top Chinese national leaders. What are some other kinds of information or data the Chinese target at private corporations?
Really what it comes down to is they're looking for whatever they can find. Some of this could just be what we're seeing now is a so-called digital recon mission. But what they're kind of doing is they're just seeing what the companies have. In some cases, such as the news organizations, such as the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, it could be finding out what sources spoke out against China. In other cases, it might be finding out what's useful for their own products or just a way to help in negotiations with those companies. Really, any intellectual property seems to be fair game. This is in many ways just goes to the Sun Tzu, knowing your enemy.
Even last week's report conceded that the problem of hacking was much larger than the operations at one building in Shanghai. What did your sources say?
Well, the sources said it's scary, that this is really just the tip of the iceberg. As one source said, there's two types of firms doing business with China today, those that have been breached and those that simply don't know they've been breached. And this is likely going to get worse as we go forward. Just because one group in China has been exposed, in this case the Shanghai group, doesn't mean that there aren't others ready to pick up if that group were to shut down or close shop.
And what do we know about the kind of information that Chinese target at U.S. government agencies, especially the Pentagon and its armies of contractors?
Well, the Chinese have long been looking at the Pentagon. What they've stolen, we don't know. The Pentagon isn't going to come out and say, you know, this top secret thing was stolen. But we know this isn't new. There was hacking back in 2007 when the Chinese hacked a non-critical Defense Department system. Then in 2008, the Chinese hackers broke into another Pentagon system. In 2011, there was a Pentagon breach that saw 24,000 files stolen. This is likely going to continue. That's about as much as we can say about it.
More threatening than theft of cyber data is the kind of cyber damage to digital operating systems, the electric grid, train, and traffic controls, the kind of sabotage campaign that Washington and Tel Aviv reportedly focused on Iranian nuclear efforts. Any evidence of that yet on U.S. soil?
Nothing that we've heard about, and again, I think the Pentagon would probably keep those cards kind of close to close to them. But I think a lot of it is this is not the modus operandi right now in the case. I think it goes back to that classic 1960s TV spy drama, The Prisoner. What they want is information.
What kind of technical countermeasures are being taken by the government and recommended to private corporations?
I think it goes back to those famous World War II posters, loose lips sink ships. It's going to be watch your data, watch for holes in the network. One thing we could do but will be unlikely to do is to block inbound IP traffic from China, just as some countries, including China, look to block some of their citizens' outbound traffic. But what we really need to do is put more diplomatic pressure against the Chinese to stop this sort of thing. And we also need pressure from businesses who say enough is enough. If this continues, we will not do business with you.
Does the Iranian campaign or the anti-Iranian campaign give any hint that there might be counterattacks on that Chinese unit or building, either digital or physical, maybe an apparently accidental short circuit or equipment fire, or is that fortunately more science fiction?
I think at this point it's more science fiction. From what some of my sources have told me, that's not something the Chinese are likely to do. We're not likely to do it against the Chinese. The scarier thing is if this sort of attack trickles down to a terrorist organization or a rogue state such as North Korea, that is a game-changing moment.
What kind of executive orders and legislation passed or proposed have the international hack attacks generated, and with what questions and controversies about undermining Americans' privacy and freedom on the Internet?
Well, President Barack Obama signed an executive order earlier this month aimed at helping protect the computer networks of crucial American industries from cyber attacks, and he also prodded Congress to enact legislation that would go even further. But as we're seeing, it's only the tip of the iceberg with the problem, and this is only the tip of the iceberg in how we can address it. Unfortunately, what the president has said right now, that's largely symbolic. What might be the better solution is to hit the Chinese where it hurts. Businesses that have been hacked should stop doing business in China. They should pull out their factories, stop making their products in China. Again, the Chinese are looking at the intellectual property, and if the product's not made in China, it's going to be that much harder for them to copy it and possibly that much harder for them to get into the networks.
Peter Suchu is a writer for Tech News World.
Quote from the news, "We started it anyway, but after half a day's digging, we gave up." That was Barbara Pittman, wife of 1960s nuclear bomb shelter pioneer Stuart Pittman, on their efforts to build a personal bunker at their home. Pittman died earlier this month at the age of 93.
Next, Discovering Black America, for your ears only. Welcome back to For Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "Making life fair for all women seems more important than breaking a barrier for one woman." That was feminist author Gloria Steinem in the 50th anniversary week of Betty Friedan's iconic feminist mystique, threatening to end her support for New York City Council head Christine Quinn as a candidate for mayor if Quinn did not permit a vote on sick leave legislation. Now this.
"In my world, you gotta get dirty. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting dirty."
"What's your name?"
"Django. D-J-A-N-G-O. The D is silent."
It took the irrepressible imagination of filmmaker Quentin Tarantino to come up with a title character in Django Unchained, a former slave in sunglasses gunning down evil whites, sometimes to rap music. But 400 years of real black history in this country has a fair share of the brave, bold, and finally successful, even if we don't know all the names.
Some of those, from pre-colonial times to the civil rights era and the age of Obama, are brought to life in the recent book Discovering Black America, From the Age of Exploration to the 21st Century, published by Abrams. And to continue our recognition of Black History Month for Your Ears Only, author Linda Tarrant Reed is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
What led you to take on such a large, important, and sometimes controversial subject, and how long did it take you to write the book?
I had worked as the managing editor on several important projects focusing on African-American history and culture. And in 2001, I published my first book, Discovering Black New York. So after Discovering Black New York, I decided to set my sights on a more expansive history, one that would be geared to the young reader as well as adults, because I found through researching these other books that the whole story had not been told. DBA took me about 6 years to write, and am I glad, because it was originally slated to be published in 2008, and I would have missed including the election of the first African-American president.
Now, DBA includes archival photographs, reproduced documents, as well as first-person narratives from detailed diaries and original journals. How did you learn about and get access to these materials, and which presented the greatest challenge?
I am a researcher and journalist at heart, so digging and investigating comes second nature to me. As you know, the Internet is vastly improved from the early days when it was laden with doctoral theses and other information that was not vetted. Now the National Archives, the Library of Congress, the National Park Service, as well as collections from public, private, and research libraries are now available online. Also, state and local historical societies helped me find, you know, the source for this information. I also traveled to Jamestown, Virginia, where the first permanent British settlement is located.
Let's turn to some of the content. Your book profiles a black crewman aboard Christopher Columbus's ship, the Nina, as the old world discovered the new. What was his role? How did he happen to be there?
Well, the black crewman was on board the Nina. He was a free man born in Spain of African descent. And his name was Pedro Alonso Nino. After returning from Columbus's 1492 voyage, Nino asked the Spanish crown for permission to head up his own expedition to explore the Caribbean in search of gold and pearls. Nino and his crew returned to Spain with a shipload of goodies and was accused of holding out and was arrested. He died before his trial at the age of 30.
Talk about some of the black people you were most surprised to learn about in the colonial period.
Well, the most surprising black people from that period were the Anthony Johnson family. Anthony Johnson arrived in Jamestown, Virginia in 1621 from Angola, Africa, and he was purchased not as a slave, but as an indentured servant. His wife, Mary, came a year later, the woman who would become his wife, and after 7 years, because they were indentured servants, they were granted their freedom and land. The Johnson family, the Anthony Johnson family, amassed 800 acres of land during that period. And it's documented in court records from 1651 to 1654.
And black roles in the Revolutionary War?
Well, the black patriots played a significant role in the American Revolution. There were quite a few heroic black patriots who fought at Bunker Hill in Massachusetts. For example, Peter Salem, Prince Hall, who was founder of the Black Masons Fraternal Organization, and Barzilli Lou, a flautist, who played Yankee Doodle Dandy to rally the troops during the bloody Bunker Hill engagement.
Last week on this show, we discussed the Emancipation Proclamation and Southern slaves who escaped to fight for the North. But we heard that some stayed to fight with the Confederacy. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. One black Confederate regiment was composed of free men of color, and they were the first Louisiana Native Guards, and they were formed in 1861. This all-black regiment did not remain a Confederate unit long because of the distrust of the Southern authority over the black soldiers' allegiance to their call. The first Louisiana Native Guard was renamed the Corps d'Afrique and joined the Union cause in 1862 and fought against the Confederate Army.
There's a two-page spread in your book on black inventors. Who were the biggest surprises for you in that category?
Of the black inventors, I was surprised to see how many African Americans contributed to the communications and transportation industries. Granville T. Woods, who was known as the Black Edison, invented a process that combined telegraph and telephone technology. His invention enabled operators to send and receive messages more quickly. He also developed a device that allowed trains to communicate with each other. And Louis Latimer, the inventor of the carbon filament for electric lamps, also created the patent drawings for Alexander Graham Bell's application for the telephone in 1876.
And who are some of the lesser-known leaders of the civil rights movement you mentioned?
Whitney M. Young, Jr., the executive director of the National Urban League. Young, who had a different approach to securing equal opportunity for blacks, had the ear of President Lyndon Johnson, whose war on poverty was modeled on Whitney Young's domestic Marshall Plan.
Linda Tarrant Reed is author of the book Discovering Black America, From the Age of Exploration to the 21st Century, published by Abrams.
Morehouse College Choir. Now, this quote from the news, "Now we can resume regular programming." That was ABC's Good Morning America anchor Robin Roberts on returning to the show from a medical leave for a rare blood disease likely caused by earlier treatments for breast cancer.
Next, Ocean Cruise Blues, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. This will give everyone a cold shower. That was John Shaw of the risk management company SW Associates in Paris on the quick commando-style raid by eight hooded gangsters on a Brussels airport to grab $50 million in diamonds. Now this.
At Carnival, our promise to our guests is to provide a great vacation experience, and we try very hard to do that all the time. It's obvious in this particular case, we did not deliver on that promise.
Carnival Cruise President and CEO Jerry Cahill might have walked away with the Oscar for understatement, if there was such a thing, for his press conference earlier this month on the plight of the inappropriately named Carnival Triumph. After 4 days at sea with no power, little food, and only the most primitive sanitation for 3,000 passengers and 1,000 crew.
No one died, and most passengers praised the emergency care and morale boosting by Carnival employees. But the offer of full fee return, a free cruise in the future, and $500 cash did not satisfy all passengers, though quite in keeping with the contracts they signed. Nor did it answer the larger question. Has mass cruising for the middle class produced fleets of monster ships, some with up to 6,000 aboard, that Boston Globe columnist Gillette Cayham dubbed too big to bail?
Too big for easy evacuation, that is. Maybe too big for some ports of call that previously thought tourism just their cup of tea. To consider these and related issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined now by Peter Greenberg, travel editor for CBS News, also at Peter Greenberg Worldwide and petergreenberg.com. Welcome to our program.
Happy to be with you.
The Carnival Company already had a big blotch on its record, a ship that ran aground with fatal consequences.
Yeah, they did. That was the Costa Concordia more than a year ago. But in this particular case, the real issues here are threefold. One, what was the condition of the ship before it set sail? Were there problems that the cruise line knew about and did not disclose to passengers? And then once the issue happened, which is the fire in the engine room, how quickly did they solve that problem? And then what was their plan of getting the passengers back home? And that's what's really going to be the key to the legal action that is going to be taken or may or may not be upheld in the court.
And how do you rate their performance on those three scores?
Well, let's first of all start with the fire itself. Any ship captain will tell you that the most terrifying thing you can happen to see is an onboard fire. And modern cruise ships are equipped with very good state-of-the-art fire suppression systems and enunciator panels on the bridge. So in this particular case, you had an oil line that ruptured. It started a fire in the engine room. The bridge was notified immediately electronically that they had a fire in the engine room. And they did two or three very important things. One, they shut down the ventilation system on the ship because the fastest thing that's going to spread a fire is the air conditioning system. The second thing they did is they closed all the watertight doors. And then the third thing that they did, knowing what would be produced, is they activated their fire suppression system. And what that did is it flooded the engine room with chemicals that not only starved the fire, but it knocked out anything that operated on fuel, meaning the engines and the generators. So the good news is no one died. They were able to put the fire out, which could have been catastrophic. The bad news is at that point, they weren't going anywhere. They had no propulsion. They had no ventilation. They had no refrigeration. They had no electricity.
Is it your feeling that these ships, which have really become sort of floating cities, they're so monstrously big, need a better design of backup systems so that something which really was pretty simple, I mean, a fuel backup line, could be so devastating, it could be dealt with even better?
Yeah, you know, when you have a ship of that size and mass, you need a backup electrical system not located in the same direction or position as the engine room. And I think the newer ships are going to have that. There is a minor backup system that can operate radios and some emergency equipment, but certainly nothing to operate all the basic systems on the ship. Remember, what really complicated matters in this case is that the waste management system on the ship was electrically operated, which means the toilets were flushing electrically and hydraulically. When the electrical system failed, the toilets didn't flush. In fact, they overflowed.
Would less strict limits on lawsuits, especially when there's no serious injury or death, provide an incentive for better maintenance, emergency backup systems and such?
Well, interestingly enough, when everybody bought their cruise on Carnival and they signed their cruise ship package, that contract has a specific clause in it that says, by agreeing to take this cruise and by paying for this cruise, you give up your right to be a part of a class action suit against us. Now, the fact that they put that in the contract may be meaningless because it's never been tested in court. Now it may be tested in court because there's a class action suit, at least one of them that I know about, with about 400 participants. So it remains to be seen if the judge will hear that or dismiss it. If the judge decides to hear it, Carnival will probably move very, very quickly to settle the cases because they don't want to set precedent.
What about reports these cruise ships have become so large that some popular ports are becoming concerned about endless cruise day invasions? Maybe we'll limit the size of ships or how frequently they can sail in.
Well, this has already happened in certain locations like Bermuda, which has a cruise ship moratorium on how many ships can actually be in the harbor at any one time. But that's not necessarily a safety issue. That's a commerce issue from hotels that think they're not getting any revenue from people who don't stay there. They're only there for 5 hours and leave. But if you take a look at the Inside Passage in Alaska, where you can have as many as 39 ships in the passage at any one time, you're dealing with some tremendous complications in those ports where their resources are taxed heavily when you have each of these ships with a minimum of 2,000 passengers, some as many as 5,000 passengers, coming in on the same day. That's nuts.
And what about the vacation experience itself? It's hardly a getaway with thousands of other people on the boat and flooding into the ports you might prefer to see free of so many visitors just like yourself.
Well, you know what? In defense of the cruise experience, and I've taken many cruises, the ships have done a very good job of giving people a diversity of activities and experiences on board as well as on shore, and you're not really crunched in. A lot of extra space, because remember, cruise ships don't make money when they sell you the cabin. Cruise ships make money on onboard revenue for all the different experiences you might want to have on the ship. So they're very cognizant of giving people opportunities on the ship. The real problem, as you just mentioned, is what happens when these ships come ashore and you've got to basically disembark 4,000 to 5,000 people at a time. That gets a little crazy.
Peter Greenberg is travel editor for CBS News, also at Peter Greenberg Worldwide and petergreenberg.com.
Out on the burning, with the moon big and shining, melting your heart out of stone. I'd love to get you on a small boat to China, all to myself alone.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to DavidEarsOnly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Anger Studio Play It Productions with interns Justin Griffith and Sean Deary. I'm Eddie Robinson.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment. Normally a major story on our show a year ago, I'm Sean Deary. This week, to mark the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's iconic feminist rallying cry, The Feminist Mystique, we dig back nearly 2 years to our discussion of a new book about that book from our March 13th, 2011 broadcast hosted by David and Catherine Herzog.
Well, you know this has been the most fabulous conference, the non-governmental, the voluntary organization conference here in Nairobi. I think it is historic. I think it is the worldwide explosion of the women's movement.
The late Betty Friedan on this show from the 1985 conference in Nairobi, Kenya, ending the United Nations decade for women, with 14,000 of them in attendance. And to a degree, as back home in the United States, Friedan was right. Women almost everywhere have gained new status and influence, if not as much as they merit, or at least the consciousness of it, even in still repressive male-dominated societies. But what was the real role of Friedan herself and of her first and most famous book, The Feminine Mystique, which made Betty both a heroine to some and a target for others?
Another former guest on our show, Stephanie Kuntz, has dug back through the decades for a better fix on Friedan and her book about the malaise of homebound housewives, at least in the white middle class, that now may seem foreign to a generation of successful female executives and overburdened working moms. Kuntz is professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College and author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, new from Basic Books. Welcome back to For Your Ears Only.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you again.
First, remind us how Betty defined the feminine mystique and the problem she saw it producing.
Well, it was, she called it, and I took my book title from this, A Strange Stirring. a yearning, a sense among a large layer of women in the post-war era who could be thought that they'd gotten everything a woman could possibly want, or everything that society told women could possibly want at that time. They'd married good providers. They had adorable little children. For the first time, they were free from the hardships of the Depression. Their husbands and fathers were experiencing income growth and job security. But they felt there was something missing. They felt empty. Physicians called it the housewife syndrome, crying for no reason, mental numbness, sometimes physical numbness. Psychiatrists said that the normal woman would certainly want no other satisfaction in life and prescribe tranquilizers. And Friedan said, no, this feeling is a legitimate reaction to being relegated to a single limited role. Women also have a need to use their talents to find some meaning or social challenge in life, not instead of their families, but in addition to their families.
And indeed, these are women with college degrees in many cases, sometimes the first in their families, maybe not, but there was the degree on the wall and it was more decoration. Her prescription for the problem, though, was hardly what we would think of now as radical.
No, as a matter of fact, she titled the first excerpt of her book that was published in a magazine, and you know how magazines like to have very exciting, controversial titles. She said, "I say women are people too." And this was considered radical at the time. You know, it's sort of a big duh right now, but it is really important for us to know how radical it seemed at the time. Her proposals were not that women should go out and become careerists. In fact, she specifically argued against trying to get work just for the sake of consumerism. Perhaps her only real concrete proposal was that there ought to be a GI Bill to reintegrate housewives and mothers who'd left the labor force to have children back into the labor force, just as they were integrating veterans, mostly male veterans, who'd fought in World War II. But this insistence that women are people, too, went against the cultural mores of the 1950s and early 60s.
Well, Betty did like the role of founding mother, but clearly her complaint would not have become a bestseller if it didn't connect with a sentiment already well along. What else was happening on the feminist or women's rights front in that period?
Well, first of all, feminism had not completely died out. There were many women who believed in equal rights who were working in the government behind the scenes. They had just convinced President Kennedy to set up the President's Commission on the Status of Women. Some were working in the labor movement to make life easier. And at the same time, there were all of these contradictory messages that set women up to listen to Friedan. This was a period when women were being pulled into the workforce, but only in very limited kind of jobs. They had to go to the help wanted female section of the paper. They had low paid jobs. If you did have a college degree and worked full time, you earned less than the average male high school dropout. They were supposed to abandon their jobs as soon as they married or had kids and then devote themselves completely and get complete fulfillment out of wives and mothers. But at the same time, cultural critics were telling them that they were smothering their children and burdening their husbands. And then when their kids got grown, they were suddenly accused of being parasites, so they should go back to work, but make sure their jobs didn't pay enough to threaten their husband's sense of being a provider or interesting them enough. So, you know, women were just getting coming and going.
The absence of working women and minority women among her subjects bothered you at first, Betty's insensitivity to their problems and the lessons their lives could actually teach.
Well, you know, it's very ironic that Betty Friedan's book didn't talk about this, because Friedan herself had been an activist on behalf of union women. She was against segregation. She organized in her own neighborhood to end segregation. But she did ignore those women in her book. She had shifted to becoming a freelance writer for the women's magazines, and she realized that the women with a little more privilege than average were also feeling discontent about a different set of things. So she set out to talk to them. And, you know, many commentators have since argued that black women, you know, would have loved to have the problems she talked about in her book. But I found in researching this book that that's not really true, that the real tragedy of her ignoring the special issues facing black women was that black women had already pioneered the idea that you could have a three-part identity. Black men and women leaders of the 20s and 30s had argued that a woman could be a good wife and mother and still be a co-provider for her family and also be a community activist. So Friedan could have pointed to their path-breaking example, actually.
But the power her book held for the women she did write about and for finally won you over, too. Talk about some of the She Saved My Life stories that you collected.
Oh, my gosh. I was just, that's what really stunned me in doing this. You know, my mother had read The Feminine Mystique and had called me when I was away at college to tell me all about it and what it meant to her. But doing these interviews with almost 200 women who read the book at the time, the most common phrase I heard was, I thought I was crazy. I thought I was crazy. Others were just given tranquilizers. A woman who went on to become one of the major sociologists in this country told me that she was sitting around, she was on tranquilizers, she would wander around in a daze saying to herself, you're so selfish, you're going to be punished. That's what happens to people who are selfish. She said she read that book, and halfway through she flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet.
Stephanie Kuntz is professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College and author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, new from Basic Books.
The World She Remade, from our March 13, 2011 broadcast. Last week, as multitudes of women and men celebrated the feminist mystique at 50, came news of an imminent attempt to update Fredan's feminist wake-up call. Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg, formerly a top Google executive, plans a star-studded March 11th launch for her manifesto titled Lean In, and what she hopes will become a nationwide network of lean-in circles to share her prescription for women in less lofty situations. Demand more from bosses, spouses, and themselves. I'm Sean Deary. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more from the Morehouse Choir. We shall all